The next case set for argument is Mary Langbane versus Michael Langbane. We have Stacy Hagee, who will be arguing on behalf of Mr. Langbane, and Michael Steve, who will be arguing on behalf of Ms. Langbane. Jess Pekarski is also present in the courtroom on behalf of Ms. Langbane. Each side will have 15 minutes for your arguments, and then Ms. Hagee, you'll have a five-minute rebuttal. You can proceed at this time, Ms. Hagee.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. It's your house now. I don't care what you do with it. The farm is your deal. I know nothing about farming. Do what you need to do to run the farm. Construed in the light most favorable to Michael Langbane, the evidence, including Mary's own admission, supports that Mary Langbane repeatedly made these statements to Michael. Relying on those statements, Michael did just that. He operated the farm, as well as caring for his mother through paying bills and making repairs, renovations, and improvements to the farm and the home place. In this case, the circuit court improperly weighed the evidence against Michael, including the above statements, and resolved factual disputes on summary judgment motions. As a brief summary of the facts construed in the light most favorable to Michael, Mary and Richard Langbane and their only child, Michael, operated a farm in Beadle County, South Dakota. Richard and Mary executed mirror image trusts where each put 50% undivided interest into their respective trust, with the surviving spouse as a sole income beneficiary and Michael as the remainder beneficiary. Now, a focus of the estate plan, as evidenced by the trust language itself, was for Michael to have the opportunity to operate the farm. Consistent with that, the trust specifically allowed Michael to rent the farm ground and at a rate below fair market value. Now, Richard passed away in 2008, and subsequently in 2009, Mary entered a 10-year lease agreement with Langbane Land and Cattle with Michael as its sole owner. Michael then operated the farm and handled many of the financial affairs of his mother, paying auto insurance, health insurance, property taxes, and things of the like. Now, unfortunately, 9 years into that 10-year lease period, Michael suffered serious health issues. And rather than having the property sit idle and with rent due, Michael entered into two separate leases, which encompassed his own land as well. The rent Michael charged was higher than his own rent obligation under the initial 10-year lease, but Michael continued to utilize those funds to pay towards his mother benefit and for the benefit of the property. Then Mary subsequently brought three lawsuits relevant to this appeal, and without any evidentiary hearings or trial, the court removed Michael as co-trustee of his father's trust. The court granted Mary's motion for partial summary judgment in determining that Michael breached his fiduciary duties and awarded a judgment of over $500,000 to Mary. And finally, the court granted Mary's motion for partial summary judgment on Michael's counterclaims for unjust enrichment and quantum merit.
Are you arguing, counsel, that Michael was not acting as a fiduciary when he entered into the lease? And if so, was that raised below?
Your Honor, I believe it was raised below. Throughout this proceeding, it's been argued that the trust itself allowed for this transaction for Michael to rent the property himself. And in that regard, he was not acting as a fiduciary. He was acting as the lessee of the property, not the lessor.
So the property, as I understand, at issue pertained to property that also belonged to Mary's separate trust. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
I just want to make sure we're applying whatever is the applicable governing trust language when we're analyzing these issues. So is there anything in Mary's trust, any language in Mary's trust, that at all affects our analysis here?
Your Honor, I would respond to that as, for Mary's trust, Mary is the sole trustee. in for purposes of her 50% undivided interest. She has unbridled authority to lease the property to whoever she wants. Michael is not a co-trustee and would owe no fiduciary duties under the trust to Mary in that situation.
So your position then is his authority to lease the property that Mary's trust owned came by virtue of the lease, not by virtue of any fiduciary relationship he had with Mary?
Correct, Your Honor. So the question of whether he was acting as a fiduciary, it would even only be related to the 50% undivided interest that is within his father's trust.
But don't we have to separate whether we're talking about the initial lease or we're talking about the sublease? Because it doesn't seem like there's any real problem with the initial lease. And your submissions seem to indicate in the circuit court that you had this acknowledgement that Michael had authority to lease and self-deal as a co-trustee, and he could sell, convey, pledge, mortgage this land as he saw fit. But the question becomes, for this appeal, whether he had the authority not to lease it, but to sublease it. When he subleased it, he subleased it not only on behalf of the credit trust, or the credit shelter trust, but he also leased it on behalf of Mary's living trust, and he was the power of attorney for his mother. So under those circumstances, it seems like his authority as a fiduciary is very much in play for the sublease. And would we go to the sublease to resolve the question of authority, or would we rather go to the trust instrument to determine whether he had the ability not to lease it, but sublease it?
To answer the subleasing question, I think you look at the lease itself. Does it prohibit subleases? Here, Mary and Michael, initially the lease agreement had a prohibition that would prevent Michael from subleasing. In negotiations, that was taken out of the lease agreement itself. So the lease agreement permitted subleasing.
That might seem, but that seems backwards to me, because he can only sublease if he has the authority to sublease. So wouldn't we only construe the terms of the sublease, try to determine what's there, what's not there, all of that? Wouldn't we only do that if we first resolved, yes, this language in the trust instrument or the agreement for the credit shelter trust for his dad said you can do this? We know it said you can lease it at a below market rate for your use, and that was more important to his father than maximizing the rent for the land. He said, for Michael's own use, I'm getting the text up here, pardon me, but isn't that, don't we have to resolve that before we construe whether he can sublease it? He has to have the authority to sublease it before he can execute an agreement to sublease it.
I don't think so, Your Honor. Here, he was a tenant in the transaction. Again, he had no fiduciary duty, or he was not acting as a co-trustee. I recognize that he signed it under various titles, but you have to look at what authority he had under those various titles.
Well, I don't think he can selectively say, I'm now wearing my co-trustee hat or I'm now wearing my tenant hat. He can only self-deal with the property of the trust if the trust instrument allows him to. And I'll acknowledge it seems like, although I don't know, but it seems like there's an argument that last provision of that operative portion where it says, what I just said earlier, hey, it's more important that Michael have this land, and it's not as important to me as getting rent from the farm real estate is not as important to me as the right of my son, Michael, to have the use of such land. Therefore, I direct that the land may be rented for less than fair rental income. It doesn't exactly say he gets to do it in so many words, but it contemplates a lower rate, so that would suggest that he gets to deal with the trust even with his co-trustee status. So that seems to be an argument that would allow self-dealing, at least to that extent. What's the text that says, in addition to that, his use of land would contemplate subleasing?
The evidence on the record shows that subleasing was part of this farmer operation. Richard, before his passing, engaged in subleasing of the land. So Michael, in continuing to do so, he was operating the farm operation in the same manner as his father did when his father was alive.
So is use where it says the right of my son, Michael, to have the use of such land, is that ambiguous, use, that term?
Perhaps. I would say to the extent it would be ambiguous, the court in this case should have went back, looked at the intent of Richard himself to interpret the trust agreement itself.
Because it seems like you're arguing use. Would you agree? It seems like use could be, hey, he's farming it or ranching it. Would you agree with that?
I would.
Yeah, and so then the additional question would be, well, could use also mean that he uses it as a means of income to sublease to somebody else? Right? And maybe there's an interpretation there. Maybe the counterinterpretation would be, no, your use can't mean you rent it to somebody else so they can use it. But I don't know. Does that signal ambiguity or not?
Our position would be that it's not ambiguous. He is using it in the same manner and fashion that his father did, to the extent that it is ambiguous. Yes, Your Honor.
So your position is express terms. He can use it, whatever that is. That's not further defined use, and it doesn't limit it. And he can rent it at a lower price and use it as he wishes.
Yes, Your Honor, and I believe Mary's own statements support that interpretation. When asked in her deposition whether she was entitled to all profits from the land itself, including grain profits, she replied, no, I think the grain profits were supposed to be Michael's. So in and of itself, she acknowledged that the use of the land for Michael, it was to operate the farm. It was to allow him to operate it and profit from it. He wasn't required to operate it and give 100% of the profits to her in addition to paying
that. That would be consistent with the language that the circuit court interpreted, meaning this direct, what I'll call kind of a direct use as opposed to an indirect use. That would be, no one seems to have challenged that he got to do that. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but no one seems to challenge that. It's this additional step of whether this indirect use or subleasing is also authorized. So I see a distinction there.
The issue is that the trust agreement doesn't distinguish between the two. It doesn't say, okay, you can have the profits from the land, from the grain, but you can't have any other profits, or it'd be unclear then where the line is drawn. I would point out that to this date, Mary has not articulated what Michael was supposed to do in this situation. Was he supposed to sit on the land, have his rent obligation due, and not be able to get any sort of profit from the land? Here, when you look at that, he did what he was supposed to do. He leased it out, he got profits, and then he used those to Mary's benefit. So I really think the breach of fiduciary duty isn't necessarily looking at whether entering into the subleases themselves was a breach, but it would be whether Michael himself profited from those subleases. If he was bringing in funds and using any profits to Mary's benefit and caring for her and paying her bills, then is there really a breach of fiduciary duty at all?
Would you also address, counsel, the quantum merit and unjust enrichment?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. It's really one of semantics, in my opinion. Michael should have been allowed the opportunity to present the payments that he made on behalf of his mother in some way, shape, or form, whether it was in the damages portion of the fiduciary duty claim or whether through an unjust enrichment counterclaim. The court's rejection of the unjust enrichment counterclaim because of the existence of a lease agreement was an erroneous interpretation of the law. The court applied and looked at landlord-tenant situations and said, in this situation, there can be no unjust enrichment claims. However, I think as recently as Houston versus Martin in 2018 and back to the commercial bank case, those cases allow the courts to look at the actual behavior of the landlord and whether that behavior was inequitable and supported unjust enrichment. Here, we don't need to look any further than Mary's own statements that Michael could do whatever he wanted with the house because it was his house now. I think you can also look at the sworn testimony of Michael regarding a signed land trade agreement where Mary and Michael agreed to swap land essentially to allow Michael to have the property where the permanent improvements were placed that he was expending funds toward. even if the court were to look at the lease agreement and, you know, exclude some of the funds paid towards the property itself, the court failed to recognize that some of these payments had no ties to the land by any means. It was bills paid for auto insurance, for health insurance. And so that.
So those are more in the nature of an offset, it seemed to me, like the circuit court. There was some discussion about whether this, I mean, these equitable claims are quantum merit and unjust enrichment have specific showings, and we know what they are from our cases, and it's discussed in the record. But it almost seemed like there was just this, as you started out your argument, there seems to be some way that Michael should get credit for this, but really the only things in front of us are these two equitable theories. And maybe your offset claim is something different than those two equitable theories.
I would say it's three, actually, Your Honor, because one, I would propose that in the analysis of whether and what amount Mary was damaged as any alleged breach of fiduciary duty, an offset could arguably or should be adjusted there. Then you can look to unjust enrichment or quantum merit. If it's not allowed there, it should be allowed in some way, shape, or form somewhere else. I see my time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Adestive, you may proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Michael Steve, and I'm here today on behalf of Appellee Mary Langdean. It's a pretty straightforward case, unfortunately, about a son taking advantage of his mother while under her confidences as a fiduciary. While opposing counsel really addressed the facts in this matter, there are a few that I believe really need to be hit on. That while in 2009, while Michael, through his company, did lease the property held by the trust for fair market value, these two 2018 leases that addressed the trust property not only went to the end of his lease term, but also extended beyond the term of the original lease, showing that he clearly signed not only on behalf of himself, but also on behalf of his mother and Mary's trust, under whom he was power of attorney, but also the credit exemption trust, which he was a co-trustee, without his mother, who was also a co-trustee on that trust.
Does the power of attorney come into play here in our analysis? I could not find that in the record.
It comes into play because he then had Mary's confidences. Under the Ward v. Lane case, once you're placed into somebody's confidences, then you're held to this higher standard of duty to always ensure that their interests, that you do not use their property for your benefit.
Did the power of attorney allow him to use her authority as trustee to sign these leases?
I believe we may have addressed that in our brief, Your Honor, and I believe that even if it did not, he clearly signed on behalf of his mother.
Does that matter if he didn't use the power of attorney or didn't have the authority under the power of attorney to sign the lease? I mean, isn't it then just a question of he exceeded his legal authority, so maybe he's in breach of contract with the subleases, but does that impact Mary?
Your Honor, Justice Jensen, I believe you're correct. As long as he is signing, even with the authority or not, he is still liable at the end of the day to Mary Langbean for the use of this trust property.
But how is he acting as a fiduciary? If he's not using the power of attorney, he's not a trustee on the trust, what's the fiduciary duty he owes to Mary for her portion of the land that's owned in the trust?
And Justice, I believe as we've more fully briefed in the Ward v. Lane case, once you step into that fiduciary hat or those fiduciary shoes, you cannot avoid it as to that person, as to the property your fiduciary power covers.
So in the Statement of Undisputed Material Facts, there was a response. And as I read it, Michael admitted to the Statement of Undisputed Material Fact that he served as Mary's power of attorney. And critically to this discussion, it also appeared that he admitted your statement of undisputed material facts that he, quote, signed sublease for land owned by the Credit Exemption Trust, Mary's Trust, and Mary personally on behalf of Mary.
Correct, Justice. And I believe that's where he becomes liable for that fiduciary duty to Mary or still for those damages for improper use and exceeding any authority he may have had to Ms. Langby.
Well, maybe I'm confused on the facts. Did Mary own any land personally?
She owned her land in a wholly revocable trust.
Right. So how could he sign for her personally if she doesn't own any land personally? What difference does it make if he signed for her personally?
I believe, Justice, the difference is that he is still as her fiduciary, that she was the individual who had the power to sign on behalf of her trust. And I believe that is where Michael becomes liable for this improper use of Mary's trust property when he signed these subleases that he did not have the power to enter into.
I want to talk to you, if I could, please, about the operative language in the trust instrument, because it seems to me that if there's a path to affirming, it's narrow. Because there's this provision of the trust instrument and has three parts. The first part says, it's my intention that Michael be in charge of all the farm assets and that he be allowed to exercise all the trustee powers outlined within the trust in his discretion. The second sentence says, notwithstanding anything else, there's three trustees. And it's my intent that any decision regarding the farm assets, don't know how that relates to the first sentence, shall be made by Michael, my wife, or either of them. It doesn't have to be unanimous. And then the third sentence is the one that we talk about maybe the most. That's the one where Richard seems to have indicated an intent for Michael to self-deal with the property of the trust, notwithstanding his position as a co-trustee and rent land, not just deal with the trust, but also have this benefit of renting at a below market value. And I want to focus on that use language. Is that ambiguous or is that clear? If it's ambiguous, the case needs to go back down and the court needs to take maybe some evidence on what Richard intended by that.
I believe it is. Sorry, Justice.
No, I'm ready.
I believe it is clear. I also believe that in order for self-dealing to be authorized, the trust must provide clear and unmistakable language authorizing it. That's under the Wyman standard, which means that unless the trust clearly authorizes him not just to use the land, but to also sublet, to retain these profits from the sublease, that would be what is necessary to self-deal, and that is not existent.
So use would not equal subleasing?
Is my opinion, Your Honor, Justice, it would not. I also believe that the lower court in the 2020 order, which is, in our opinion, binding on this matter, shows and defines the term use. That is simply a preference for Michael to farm the property, not to sublet it and be able to retain trust profits.
And you think that conclusion is made as a matter of law, so that language is unambiguous, use?
That would be our position, Chief Justice. We also believe that Michael breached in other manners as well, and only one of which would be necessary here today to affirm this breach.
For instance, the duty to keep his mother advised.
Correct. He deceived his mother, which he admitted.
I want to talk to you about that, though. He says that in his deposition that he informed his mother. Of course, she disagrees. And in the court's memorandum of opinion, this is the September one. Yeah, this is the September 22 one. The court seems to make a factual finding. It says, besides his word, the court's without evidence that the defendant informed the plaintiff of the subleases. Can the court do that under the Rule 56 standard? Because it seems like we have one witness that says one thing, we have another witness that says another thing. And if that fact is material, I don't know if it is or not, depends on how this trust instrument gets interpreted, but if that fact is material, that seems disputed.
And Justice Salter, I don't believe that fact is material because as a trustee, you have a duty to keep your beneficiary informed at all times. He also clearly deceived her. There is correspondence between her or counsel for her and Mr. Langbein or his counsel where he admits or he states there is no sublease on this property. This does not exist. All while it is clear by the subleases presented to the court that the sublease did in fact exist. So it is not material if he may or may not have stated that to her before. It's clear that he made these admissions, he made these statements with the intent to deceive her. and therefore he is liable to her damages under 5522, which states all profits made by a trustee adverse to the interests of the beneficiary, he is liable to the beneficiary for. And then they also admitted that the damages amount at hearing, they conceded that the damages at the hearing would be the amount proposed by appellee and as found by the lower court if a breach of fiduciary duty was found, which is what occurred based on not just his subleasing, but also the deception and failure to keep his mother informed.
I want to go back quickly before, and I want to give you a chance to talk about the equitable claims, but last question I've got on this operative portion of Richard's credit trust. You know, I mentioned there are those three sentences, and I kind of walked through those. How do they interact with each other? Is there ambiguity among them as to what exactly Michael's in charge of and what he can do in his sole discretion and what his mother can do by herself? And how do those sentences interact with each other?
I don't believe there is ambiguity there, Justice Salter. I believe that the first sentence would be in the situation of there being fewer than three trustees. I believe the trust instrument provides for a time frame in which there may be fewer than three trustees. However, when there are three trustees, then Mary and Michael shall have equal decision. And if there needs to be a more or less tiebreaker is when you would bring in the third trustee to handle these decisions regarding the farm assets. At the time of the subleases, there were three trustees.
Thank you.
Thank you, Justice. And then as to the unjust enrichment and quantum meruit equitable claims, all that appellees need to show is that it is impossible for appellants to prove one element of their claim, as this is a defensive summary judgment motion. Viewing the evidence most favorably to appellants, there is no material fact in which they could prove the third element of unjust enrichment, which is inequity. South Dakota law is clear. It is well-settled principle that in the absence of an agreement, the landlord will pay for an improvement or statute imposing liability. A tenant is not entitled to compensation for improvements made to a leasehold, even if they cannot be removed. Unjust enrichment does not simply arise because a landlord benefits from a tenant's efforts to improve the property. Simply put, without this agreement, it can never be inequitable for a landlord to retain improvements. Quantum meruit also has a very similar standard requiring some sort of agreement that you will be reimbursed or paid for your services. Appellants are attempting to rely on this Huston or Houston case to change this precedent. However, that holding isn't applicable here. That case is a breach of contract and estate fight claim. In fact, in that case, this court states that if it were a landlord-tenant case, such as we have in front of us today, that it would need to rely on the Commercial Trust Savings Bank standard requiring there to be an agreement before unjust enrichment can be found.
So assume we agree with you that is the law, and if it's the fence he put in and things like that, you don't get any credit for that. That's just part of your obligation as a tenant. So assume that's the case. I heard Ms. Heggie indicate that part of the claim also consisted of dollars that he paid to benefit Mary, either taking care of her and things like that. Was that claim asserted, and you think that's an appropriate claim in terms of, and maybe it's an offset, as Justice Salter indicated. Give me your thought on that claim.
My thought, Justice Jensen, would be that quantum meruit requires a similar agreement for reimbursement. That without some sort of agreement that, yes, pay for these services, I will reimburse you, I will pay you back, that it can never be an equitable for Ms. Langbein to retain the benefits of these services, and she is not liable to them.
Go ahead.
And does it matter that she repetitively told him that the house was his?
Justice Kern, I do not believe that matters. There is case law outside of the state. I do not believe there is any in this state that is almost on point to this. Of course, telling somebody that they may inherit this property later or that they may use this property later does not give them any right to make improvements and ask for reimbursements when similar to a situation here, the actual property owner then removes them from the property. It is our opinion that goes back to a landlord-tenant relationship. Under a lease, you have the right to use the property. It is yours during the term of the lease, but you are still subject to the unjust enrichment requirements of an agreement before you may get any reimbursements for improvements made, for work done to the property, etc.
The record indicates, and so far as we know, Michael remains the residual beneficiary under the credit trust.
Correct, Justice. There has been no amendment to Richard's credit exemption trust. It is an irrevocable trust that became irrevocable upon Richard's passing. He has, of course, been removed as co-trustee of the trust. I suppose in conclusion, under the Haas standard in South Dakota law, it is evident that appellee proved and appellants admitted almost every claim element necessary for appellee to win on her summary judgment motion. However, even looking beyond these admissions, based on the evidence and record, it is clear that the lower court properly found summary judgment in favor of appellee. Michael breached his fiduciary duty by subletting, he breached his fiduciary duty by deceiving, and the damages were proper, as offset is not a proper defense, it is a cause of action, and those causes of action they brought, such as unjust enrichment and quantum of root, could never be proved, as they could never prove inequity due to failure to ever provide an agreement. I see my time is running up, Justices, if I may please finish. And therefore, the lower court properly found summary judgment in favor of appellee on all matters, and as such, appellee respectfully requests the orders of the lower court be affirmed. Thank you, Justices.
Thank you, Mr. Steen. You may proceed, Ms. Hagen.
Ms. Hagen, I don't want to get too far into your time here, but in March of 2020, the circuit court held that Michael, among other things, Michael didn't have a right, and I know the provision says he has a right to rent it, but the circuit court held he didn't have a right to rent that land at a below market rate. And therefore, at that point, as you know, then Mary cut out the middle person and leased directly to these subtenants, Mr. Steele and the Du Bois Farms tenants. Has Michael appealed that determination? I don't see that raised. I don't see a claim that Michael was damaged in the form of a counterclaim or something like that. That doesn't appear to be in front of us, and that's okay if it's not, but I just want to make sure it's not.
No, it's not, Your Honor. That motion was made in the context of petition for court supervision. The ultimate holding that a lease was approved as to Mr. Du Bois and Mr. Steele, Mr. Langby did not pursue an appeal on that issue. However, I think it is noteworthy that in subsequent pleadings in the case, Mr. Langby does note that he then had the opportunity to go back and lease the property at a later point in time.
Okay. Thank you.
Addressing first opposing counsel's statement that Mr. Langby was taking advantage of his mother. Here, this isn't a Ward versus Lang situation where a side transaction was made and then money was being pocketed at the outset. Funds weren't being given back to the landowner himself. This is a situation where 9 years into a 10-year lease, with Mary knowing her son was suffering a serious illness and subleasing it out in the context of having his own rent obligation due. Second, I will note, Justice, you had asked about the power of attorney in the record. I believe the power of attorney is at the record number 818 with the subsequent revocation as it was revoked in 2019, found at record 799.
Now, is that land swapping agreement? I meant to ask you that. Is that land swapping agreement? Is that in the record somewhere or just described?
So it is described in Michael's deposition testimony as well as in the response to the interrogatories, I believe.
But it's not itself.
Itself, it is not in the record.
Thank you.
To the extent that the Du Bois and Steele leases extended and created a new lease period, it's not a breach of fiduciary duty for Michael to lease the trust assets, including the real property. In fact, the lease agree or the trust agreement itself says that Michael, in his sole discretion, is in charge of any and all farm assets and be allowed to exercise his trust powers over those farm assets in his sole discretion.
Mr. Steve says that really only applies if he's the sole trustee, or maybe one of two, but not three.
I would propose that that's an absurd interpretation of it. Why, in the context of whether he can operate and make decisions in his sole discretion, should it matter whether there is two or three trustees?
If that's the case, then how do you read the second sentence, and how do you read those two sentences together?
I would propose that you have to look at the trust agreement as a whole. When you look at that, Richard's intent and direction is clear, that Michael be allowed to operate the farm. He be allowed to use the farm assets and exercise the power over those trust assets. I think it may be ambiguous, again, reading those two sentences together, but that should then go back for the circuit court to analyze the intent behind that trust agreement. But back to the leases, in looking at that transaction between Mr. Langbein and the third-party lessees, there's no self-dealing there. He could lease to a third party. This wasn't him leasing to himself. To the extent where self-dealing would come into play would be where if he was leasing to a third party and then pocketing any proceeds. That is a question of damages and should be subject to heard by a trier of fact.
It appeared to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you did assert as a defense in the fiduciary breach of fiduciary suit with respect to the damages, these other matters that also relate to the counterclaims.
Your Honor, if you could ask your question again.
Well, it was brought up that is this just the amounts that he expended for his mother and for other purposes just relate to the counterclaims, or what were those things also asserted as a defense in the fiduciary breach of fiduciary suit?
Your Honor, as to the case was consolidated, as to the responses for the motion for summary judgment, all of that should be looked at as a whole, where all of those claims were made as to the expenses that were paid on Mary's behalf. Those are in a response to Mary's statement of material facts at record 934, as well as expenses paid towards the improvements itself, and those are at record 1119 through 1121. All of those expenses, whether it's for improvements or Mary's health insurance or to her benefit, would need to be offset against any profits to determine whether, in my opinion, whether there was any self-dealing or whether those profits were being used and being expended on Mary's behalf.
Thank you, Ms. Hickey.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case is submitted and will be in recess for 10 minutes.